So we have a very distinguished panel this afternoon on immigration. So I just want to introduce the moderator today, and then the moderator will introduce the rest of the panel. But we're really excited to have all the speakers with us today. So our moderator today is Sayu Bojwani. Sayu is a proud immigrant New Yorker who made history as the city's first commissioner of immigrant affairs. She was born in India and raised in Belize, and she advocates for social change as an author, TED speaker, and social entrepreneur. Sayu founded and led South Asian Youth Action, New American Leaders, and Women's Democracy Lab, each dedicated to advancing a sense of belonging. She was a 2023 Open Society Foundation's Equality Fellow and the author of People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates Knocking at Democracy's Door, and also the Substack Number One Immigrant Daughter. In 2024, Sayu received the Groundswell Inaugural Vanguard Award as the self-care guru. She serves on the boards of the North Star Fund and the Center for Fiction, and is also an adjunct professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and the CUNY Graduate Center. She is writing her debut novel and a nonfiction book on belonging and identity. So please welcome Sayu Bojwani.
This is a lovely full circle moment for me because many, many years ago, as Commissioner of Immigrant Affairs, I also spoke at an RE event. And so I'm really excited. I'm excited to be introducing Commissioner Ali. I'm excited that she is the Commissioner of Immigrant Affairs because I cannot think of anyone better to be an advocate for the city's immigrant communities. And I'm going to do a little more formal introduction, but I did want to start with that. And I want to thank you all for having me and say hello to all the, you know, we can't say, I don't want to say old faces, faces I've known for a long time and new faces. Let me just give you a quick overview of how the next hour and a half is going to work. I will be introducing the commissioner. She will speak about for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I will come back up with our panelists, and then we will get into a conversation, which I hope will be robust and enlightening, and there will be time for you all to ask questions. I don't believe we'll have questions from the commissioner, but I'm sure that she will answer all your questions in her remarks, so not to worry. So you have her full bio in front of you, and I'm just going to highlight a few things. I want to first point out that although I think of her as being a younger person, which she is, younger to me, she has also already served for two decades as an institutional and civic leader focused on advancing equity, civil rights, and democratic engagement. She was most recently the first deputy chief of staff at the New York City Council, where she drove institutional decision-making and priority setting. She kept the body grounded in its core public service mission. Earlier in her career, she served as director of advocacy at the Arab American Association of New York, an organizer with Brooklyn Congregations United, and director of community affairs at CARE New York. Across these roles, she built campaigns on policing, immigration reform, civil rights, and democratic participation, recruited and mentored emerging organizers, and established coalitions that continue to influence the city's civic landscape. She holds a BA in political science from Pace University. She's the daughter of immigrant parents from Azad Kashmir, Pakistan, and she is proud to have forged a career in service that is rooted in her family's dedication to compassion and collective care. Before I call the commissioner up, I also want to share that many years ago she took a training that we ran through New American Leaders, an organization that I used to, that I founded and ran for many years, and I have been waiting for this moment in which Commissioner Ali can be more front and center, because I think her incredible dedication, grace, and passion is something that we need in the front of leadership just as much as we have needed her behind the scenes. So please join me in welcoming Commissioner Faiza Ali.
I'm going to take Sayu on the road everywhere I go now. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. It's really an honor to be here. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Faiza Ali. I'm the commissioner for the New York City's Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. I want to thank CUNY's Asian American Asian Research Institute for convening this important conversation. And thank you to everyone in this room, you know, who continues to organize, teach, research, advocate, and build community during what is an incredibly consequential moment for immigrants in New York. So I want to thank you and applaud you for your work. This symposium, and I hope I'm not pressing buttons, I think I might be. This symposium asks us to reflect on both an opportunity and a challenge. And I think that that framing gets it exactly right. Because right now, many Asian Americans and immigrant communities are experiencing two different and very distinct realities at once. On the one hand, we are witnessing historic political visibility and civic engagement. The recent mayoral election showed us that political power of working class immigrant communities, including South Asians and Muslim New Yorkers, who organized deeply, they mobilized locally, and they helped shape the direction of this city. For many people, especially young Asian Americans and children of immigrants, this moment feels very affirming. It feels like proof that our communities, once who were treated as politically invisible, I'll say, that they can in fact shape public life and exercise real influence. But at the same time, many immigrant families are living through enormous fear and instability. And I think that it's important to be grounded in that reality as well. Fear of immigration enforcement, fear of family separation and detention, fear of anti-immigrant rhetoric being normalized. We see this with the questions that the mayor gets asked at his press conferences that are ridiculous. But also fear of participating in public life. You know, yesterday I visited 26 Federal Plaza where I saw that fear very first, you know, firsthand. And it was a very visceral feeling. I met New Yorkers who were simply trying to comply with the legal process. You know, what we encourage people to do. Showing up for their hearings, following the rules, pursuing lawful pathways for themselves and for their families. Instead, many of them encountered an atmosphere of intimidation and uncertainty. Masked agents roaming the halls of 26 Federal Plaza outside of immigration courtrooms, right, to intimidate families and discourage them, frankly, from even showing up to do the right thing. And moments like that really force us to confront an uncomfortable contradiction. How can communities who fully participate, or how can communities fully participate in civic life while they are simultaneously made to feel unsafe, surveilled, or disposable? And I think that contradiction really sits at the center of this moment for many Asian American communities, which hold enormous diversity as well, right, across languages, and I think we can, this room really attests for that. Diversity across languages, across religions, migration histories, class and caste, and immigration status. And, you know, while I understand why there is enormous pride in, you know, our community's growing political representation, I think there are enough organizers in this room to know that representation alone is just not enough. Not if working class immigrant families still can't afford housing. Not if undocumented families are still living in fear. Not if Muslims, Sikh, South Asian, and other communities continue to experience Islamophobia and scapegoating. And not if anti-blackness and xenophobia continue to prevent us from the kind of multiracial and class solidarity this political moment really demands of us. So I think of the most important questions for us right now is not simply how do Asian Americans gain political power, but rather what do we do with that power once we have it, right? That comes with great responsibility. And I think the Asian American community, we know a thing or two of carrying the weight of tremendous responsibility. Do we use that political power for symbolic representation? Or do we use it in this moment to build deeper solidarity, to build stronger public systems and a more inclusive democracy for everyone? You know, I want to talk a little bit about some of the work we do at MOIA. You know, we believe that immigrant inclusion has to be structural. And that means the programs that we are putting forward have to not just meet this moment, but they have to build the long-term stability of our communities. So that means access to legal services. That means language access and worker protection and education and healthcare and economic opportunity. It means all of these things at once. And it means that immigrant New Yorkers should be able to participate in the city and in access the city life without fear. You know, right now the city of New York operates the largest municipal immigration legal network in the country. We fund community-based legal providers. We focus on expanding Know Your Rights education and outreach. We're strengthening language access, working across 45 city agencies to make sure that we're not just in the business of simply translating and interpreting in different languages, which is important, but we are also, you know, creating policies with immigrant communities and language access or language justice in mind. And that we're also focusing on the realities, because we cannot ignore them, and coordinating citywide responses to a federal immigration enforcement and any emerging threats that are facing immigrant communities. So we're holding space to do all of that through our programming. And many of our strongest partners are Asian American-led organizations, some are in this room, that are deeply rooted in their communities. Right, these are organizations that have trust lifelines for immigrant New Yorkers, are the ones that government often go to because you are on the front lines as well, and that we should be seeking information from and support and guidance whenever we are rolling out policies. I want to shift a little bit and just talk about immigrants in New York, and specifically in the workforce. Because I think it's really important to highlight that nearly half of New York City's workforce is immigrant. Immigrant New Yorkers sustain entire industries, neighborhoods, small businesses, our cultural institutions, our care networks across the city. And Asian American communities in particular have shaped the economic and cultural fabric of New York for generations, from small business corridors in Flushing and in Jackson Heights to labor organizing, to mutual aid networks, to religious institutions and civic leadership across the five boroughs. So what gives me hope right now is not only the political success, though I think that is something that should be celebrated and uplifted. But what really drives, hope for me is seeing communities organize across difference, specifically seeing working class people realize the shared struggle across race and across faith and across immigration status. Because we know that there is a lot more experiences that really connect our communities, right? Many of our communities are navigating some of the same pressures, pressures that were addressed in the last mayoral election, like rising cost, housing instability, labor exploitation, language barriers, fear of immigration enforcement, divestment in public systems. I mean, the list can go on, and I'm just naming a few. And those shared realities create the possibility for solidarity. That's only if we are willing to build it intentionally. And I believe that strongly through organizing, that is how we do that. As Sayu mentioned, I am someone who comes from both an immigrant family and an organizing background. And I say this often because I connect to my organizing roots so deeply. Even having, after having spent the last 11 or 12 years working in government, because there are certain organizing values and training that you are exposed to that stays with you no matter what. And it's the belief that power is built through relationships. And that is true even in government spaces as well. A little bit about my family, because I think it's important to share and uplift, I try to do this every time, to invoke my parents. My father came to this country in the late 60s, and he started out as a dishwasher and a factory worker before he landed a good union job as an elevator operator. And I don't know if folks know, what an elevator operator is. It sounds like, someone who gets in the elevator, greets you, presses buttons, allows you to go up and down a building. But I visited my father once at his job, and I was surprised that it was one of those old school elevators that had a lever, and you had to manually crank that elevator and take people up and down a building. And he was literally powering parts of the city. The building he worked in housed doctors and nurses at 44 Morningside. They were connected to the hospital at that time with St. Luke's. I think it's Presbyterian now. So that's a little bit about my father. And my mom, you know, she raised five public school kids. I'm a middle child. Sometimes that shines through in these conversations. You know, she worked from home as a seamstress. She would sew shalwarkameez for other women in our community. And she did something really unique, not to us. I think many, you know, folks in this room might have the same experience. She opened up our home. I lived in a two-bedroom rent-stabilized apartment in Brooklyn. And she opened up our home for other families, other newly arrived families. They would come and stay with us anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months at a time. And our home was often their first stop. And so I share this because I grew up with the understanding that survival was collective, and that community is really how people survive, right? It is up to us. And so in organizing, I think that I also later learned some of the same lessons on the political side, that real power is relational. It's not transactional. It's not performative. It's deeply relational. And I think that's why I believe so strongly that this moment calls for more than just a reaction. It is, you know, forces us to reckon with the fact that we must respond to the immediate threats facing our immigrant communities directly. But I think we have to think about how we build that long-term civic infrastructure and political power that outlasts any one election or any one administration. And that means investing in community leadership and supporting local organizations. It means building pipelines in public service, right? I never imagined being in government. That was just not something that I thought was possible for myself. And so how are we creating that pipeline for communities like ours to enter policymaking? And ensuring that impacted communities are not just consulted, but they are centered in decision-making. They are driving the decision-making and policy in our city. But if immigrant communities are only visible during moments of crisis or elections, then we have failed ourselves. We haven't actually built that lasting power. And finally, I'll just say this, that, you know, local government matters enormously right now, right? If we look at what's happening in D.C., we know that while federal rhetoric remains dominant in the headlines, it's often cities that determine whether immigrant families can safely access schools, healthcare, legal support, housing, and public services. And I think it's important, I would be remiss, it's important to just state out loud, I think this is why sanctuary policies matter. This is why language access matters. This is why legal services matter and why community organizing matters. So my call to action today is really simple. It's to stay engaged. It's to stay organized. It's to build coalitions intentionally, you know, invest in local institutions, and really resist the urge to retreat into that fear and isolation that, you know, I think so many of us can find ourselves in, right? I know I had a moment of that watching families crammed into an immigration court, you know, while ICE was circling them. But it's important to sort of keep our focus on, you know, how do we build that power? Because the future for immigrant justice and the future for democracy, frankly, it depends on if we are willing to build a politics that's not just rooted in representation, but in solidarity, in dignity, and a shared responsibility for one another. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to get into some meaningful and substantive questions in a minute. But since you have these long bios in front of you, I'm going to ask our panelists to share something that's not in their bio. And I'm going to start with the commissioner. And the question that I have for you, in one sentence or so, tell us what you do, how do you spend a Saturday? And I'm sure that all of you work on Saturdays, so my question is really, what do you do beyond your actual paid job on a Saturday.
We have another job, which is cleaning on Saturday. You will find me with a bottle of bleach, scrubbing a bathroom, or tending to my fake little garden outside. Saturdays are when I'm not working. It is really a reset day. But I wanted to actually share something else, if I can. It's what I try to do every evening for like 20 minutes. And I hope this stays here and not anywhere, it doesn't get out there. Is I watch General Hospital every evening. It is something that I've been watching since I was a kid. It is 20 minutes of Sonny Corentos, if you don't know who his character. It's a way to really escape from some of the challenges and stresses because it has nothing to do with reality. And I think that it's important to have something like that, whether it's a show or an opportunity to take a walk, because I think we carry so much of our you know, we're so connected to our work that I think it's important to just kind of disconnect. So my plug for GH.
That's so disciplined, though. You don't even watch a full episode, just 20 minutes.
Well, it's on DVR, so Okay. Overing the commercials, you know, okay. 20 minutes.
Jigpreet.
So similarly, Saturdays are for cleaning. No General Hospital, I apologize, though I do love Scrubs and Grey's Anatomy. Those are my hospital shows. Saturdays are for cleaning. Saturdays are also for cooking, since it's the only time I get to cook. I do love to absolutely cook. It was my fiance's birthday this past week, and I made for the first time an ube cake, which was delicious, but the decorating looked like somebody just slopped the cream on there, which I'm trying to get better at that as well.
After working, I'll try to hang out as much as I can with my kids. And where I find therapy is actually in doing laundry. It's weird. I used to hate it. But it's like a good 2 or 3 hours of doing nothing but mindless work. So that's my go-to spot.
Hi, everyone. I'm Justin from Mekong YC. I would say is sleep for sure. But also, like, I'm interested in, like, many hobbies and stuff like that. I don't know, like, so I like to sew, so I alter some of my Cambodian traditional outfits. I scrapbook. It's really fun. It might be a little boring to people, but it's, like, sticker bombing. I love that. It's so fun. But, like, it's just listening to music for sure, because that helps me wind down, or just, like, beats in general. I feel like that is, like, perfect. And then sleeping your time away, because this work is really hard.
That's why I started with that question. So to my left is Justin Sray. He's the coordinator of the Southeast Asian Defense Project at Mekong. Murad Awade, who's the president and CEO of New York Immigration Coalition. And Jagpreet Singh, who is the first deputy commissioner of the Office of Mass Engagement for New York City, and, of course, the commissioner. So I'm going to start with my first question. And we'll see if all four of you, this is why I did humanities and not math, all four of you can answer this question. And the commissioner started off with talking about this moment being an opportunity and challenge, right? I think about how we, especially as New Yorkers, are experiencing this contradiction of pride in our civic gains by the election of Mayor Zoran Mamdani, as well as this resistance to an anti-immigrant and xenophobic regime. And while so much of what we are experiencing is not new, the contours of it, the intensity of it, the unpredictability of it is absolutely specific to this moment. So I thought that I would start each of you off by asking you to reflect on this political moment from the standpoint of where you sit. I guess you have sort of already answered this question, Commissioner. Some of you are organizers, some of you were organizers and are in government in a different capacity. The question is, what do you see as the most pressing concern for AAPI New Yorkers, and how does your work seek to address that concern?
So for me, I started this work or joined Mekong when I was 14 years old, and my parents are refugees, and they came from the Khmer Rouge genocide. And I've noticed that from our community's perspective, a lot of our communities have been, like, they rely on government assistance. And a lot of those things have been getting cut now, and it's honestly really scary and really hard. And especially because of Trump 2.0, and it's because when he first came in, there's been a lot of a deportation crisis that's affecting the South Asian community for the last 20 years. So for Mekong, we try to help our folks with so we do a lot of Know Your Rights stuff. So we have a lot of materials that we've released because of the crisis and everything. And also like voter rights, telling our crew members, having them a better sense of who to vote for, or just going out to vote, because like what the commissioner said earlier, voting is very important, especially like right now during these times. And we want like our young folks to be engaged too. So we have some of our Mekong young folks here too as well, some of our youth. So it's really important right now for our voices to be heard, especially for the Southeast Asian community. I feel like our voices aren't really that heard. And a lot of people only know about us as just war and genocide. And people are so much more than that. We have a rich arts and culture that we use to heal ourselves together, like gardening, for example. We're having our next garden day on May 31st, if anybody's interested. No, 29th. So there's like a lot of things that we do with Mekong that's very intentional for our community and for our young folks. And I feel like for me, joining in as a youth and being a pipeline of now being a staff, I'm just so grateful and proud to be Cambodian and proud to be Southeast Asian and proud to be a voice for my community, when I know that a lot of the times it's really hard for our folks to speak up, especially during these times of like folks getting deported and all these other things. And there's like major issues that are more important than myself that I feel like I have to speak upon too.
I'll take both mics. I think this moment specifically reflect for me, when I reflect on it, it illustrates the compounding of horrific policy for generations in this country. And, you know, we don't have to go too far back to remember the Chinese Exclusionary Act. We don't have to go too far back to see what a Muslim ban was. We're currently living in one again. I think for what I often think about is how the two-party system in this nation has really destroyed the working-class people, and how Republicans often say the most horrific and horrendous things, and then Democrats take those horrific and horrendous things, I'm not being partisan, and turn that into policy. And I've been at the NYC for 13 years, and I started when Obama was there, and previous to him was Bush. Bush was, you know, supposed to be the champion of immigration reform, and that deal did not happen because of September 11th. Then Obama came in and became the mass deporter in chief, and actually set the highest standards and created the good immigrant, bad immigrant, amazing narrative that we still have to deal with today, where he coined the phrase, we're fighting for families, not felons, as if felons cannot be in families. And then you fast forward to Trump 1.0, which the Obama administration helped really create on the anti-immigrant stances. And then we saw what Trump did, the Muslim ban, trying to end the diversity visa, which a lot of AAPI communities rely on to be able to come here, family reunification, which is the number one way that AAPI families are reunified here in the United States. And then Biden, where he pretty much gutted asylum. And instead of taking leadership at the southern border, he allowed Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, to use people and their bodies as political footballs. And he just randomly bussed people across the country to make a statement. And now we're living under Trump 2.0. And I think this moment, for me specifically with the AAPI community, that I often think back about is the narrative of model minority continues to illustrate and rear its head everywhere you think of. And one of the communities that's most erased in the immigration conversation is the AAPI community, because the assumption is they are the model minority. And because of that, there isn't any issue. And that's actually not the case. A lot more AAPI folks are at risk of detention and deportation. There was a stat that came out yesterday that showed of there have been hundreds of thousands of people who've been detained erroneously or for simply going to court, as Faiza mentioned in her, the commissioner mentioned in her comments earlier. 26 Federal Plaza is where more than half of the nation's courtroom detentions happened. Half. They knew that going to doors and knocking on doors and telling people open up isn't going to work, because everyone in this room and all the plethora of organizations doing Know Your Rights work actually were getting the word out. You don't have to open up your door without seeing a judicial warrant. So they thought, let's just get people who are coming to us. And those people are actually people who are applying for immigration relief. And what was illustrated in the stats that were released yesterday is that there were over 12,000 habeas petitions filed in court. Over 10,000 of them were successful in saying that the detentions were illegal and that the Trump administration was breaking the law. Of the 12,000, over 10,000 were successful. What does that what is that telling you? This is an administration that cares nothing of the law, and they want to deliver on the promise that no one really asked for their mass deportation agenda. And what every single person, even if you look at the 2024 exit poll, said, and further you get into communities of color, the deeper you'll see how much of a bigger issue this was in communities of color who were facing this for years prior, was the number one issue was the affordability crisis. And people not being able to afford food, paying their bills, their rent, and instead this federal administration's hell-bent on making this nationwide again. That's their goal. But what actually gives me hope is that we are, even as we continue to see this war being waged against all of our communities, it is everyday people stepping up to fight back. And that's what continuously gives me hope every single day.
Thank you. Chikwi, do you mind if I do a different question for you, sort of building on something that Mara said? And then you can feel free to add more if you like. I was going to ask this question about this, you know, this idea that we're having an Asian moment or a South Asian moment or a Muslim moment in New York, right? And then, Murad, you reminded me, you know, because you mentioned the model minority, that one of the things that can happen in this month of May is that there is a lot of reverence of Asian exceptionalism, right? And so the thing is that many of us do like being a model minority, right? It serves our own perceptions of ourselves, and I don't need to explain to you all why that is, but if you live in a place that wants to demonize you and then sometimes tells you you're amazing, that's like, all right, I'll take that part. You know, it's like being the child of an Asian parent kind of thing. And so I wondered if maybe both, if you, Jagpreet, and the commissioner could talk about how it both hurts us and how it might be benefiting us to be in this moment. And again, I think it's a more specific to New York because obviously South Asians nationally are not having a moment politically that we're particularly excited about. So if you could just talk about the complexity of that, of being able to build on the actual political power that we exerted in this election, but then to sort of, you know, give it some more complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Asian American New Yorkers have been part of the political process here in New York City for a long time. Back in the early to mid-1900s, Congressmember Seller was supported by a large part of the South Asian diasporic leaders like J.J. Singh, Mubarak Ali. This is the same person who ended up working on the Naturalization Act and making sure that Asians were able to come here and be able to get naturalized. But unfortunately, for a long time, that participation was only looked at as the angle of either extreme policymakers or extreme donors. Those are the two categories that Asian Americans were allowed to participate in politics as. We were not, for a long time, a subject or a part of the political discussion. More often than not, working class issues were never looked at as API issues. But at the end of the day, you know, I come from a working class family, a mixed status family here in New York City. the kind of Asian exemplary images that we would see in media or orchestrated around never really truly represented my family at the end of the day, or many of the people that I had known. But at the end of the day, housing instability is an AAPI issue. Worker justice is an AAPI issue. Disability justice is an AAPI issue. Immigration is an AAPI issue. And this is one of the things I'm thankful for this last election, and what our mayor has been able to do is really elevate that these are AAPI issues at the end of the day, and it's not just this Asian exceptionalism that we need to focus on, but part of the work that was done last year and the part of the work that we continue to do is make sure we are building the leadership of our communities, especially within AAPI communities, to take the helm and take the charge and be able to lead these fights, to be able to share their stories within the global struggle, whether it is around housing issues, whether it's around immigration issues, and make sure that our narratives are being shared is a part of the wider fabric around these stories. I think that is what I look at as the Asian moment or the South Asian moment or the Muslim moment, is that now we are a part of this fight as well. Our job, both within government, within community organizations, I was an activist and organizer for the last decade and a half, but I think in total our work right now is now to elevate the leadership of these communities, to make sure that they have the resources and tools they need to be able to fight the fight, to be able to get involved. And the only way we're able to make big wins is by having a diversity of voices, is by making sure that the experiences that we all bring in, as unique as they are part of the fight.
Thank you. I think our deputy commissioner answered that really well. The only thing I'll add is kind of taking up maybe a more political lens to this. You know, a lot of the work, the reason why we were successful, I think, in New York City this past election cycle is that there were new voters that came into the space. There were also new organizers, right? That pool of voters and organizers is what expanded. And I think the way that took decades, right? That precedes the work that Jaga has done, that I've done, or any one of us on this panel have done. But a lot of the groups that we worked with were nonprofit organizations, 501c3s, who thought of civic engagement just as like registering voters and not necessarily as informing our communities, because we're limited because of our nonprofit status, of like, who do you vote for? So voter education was very limited. And it wasn't up until maybe a little over, I think, a decade ago, that many of us started thinking about how do we organize politically and in a partisan way. And I think that there was like a shift that happened there, where a lot of these nonprofit organizations that are deeply rooted in community, that have community trust, started developing a political arm. Those very same communities started organizing politically and changing also how government and how campaigns run. That is like the underlying success of this past mayoral campaign. And I think I believe it's unique to New York, just given how diverse are and how many organizations power our immigrant communities, but it was those organizations that started thinking about political power in a different way and really redefining it. And I think there was a lot of alignment there, but that took decades of real community organizing, and I think then shifting a little bit to understanding that if we want to change what politics in New York City looks like, then we have to engage it on our own terms. And I think organizations like DRUM, and you know, I'll shout out MDCNY, like, we started to see that early on. And I think that that's what was different in this moment than in past elections.
Thank you. I also want to lift up the point that you made about solidarity, right? Because the thing that I experienced a lot when I was running New American Leaders, which was training first and second generation Americans to run for public office, is that the folks we were training were often being told that, you know, it's not your time. People are not going to vote for someone like you, or your community doesn't vote, right? Which is all sort of the different ways that the same message was being sent. And I think what the mayoral election, this election showed us, is that we can elect a candidate independent of whether the voter base is a majority identified with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's, we don't have a majority Asian American voter base. But a candidate like Zoran Mamdani can win anywhere, should be able to win anywhere. That identity is part of the part of who he is, but it is not the strategy for winning. And so I want to lift up the fact that Asian American candidates can run in any district in New York City or state or country, regardless of what the voter composition is in that district. And I want to lift up the fact that we're talking about this idea of running with a set of issues and voter concerns in mind and not with the identity first. And that is the way in which I think the solidarity shows up. I want to talk a little bit more now about voters, though, because there was this, there is this sort of, I don't think it's an anomaly. I think there's a reason for it, and it's part of why I want to talk about it. And I think, Murad, you touched on it a little bit. So this question maybe more for Murad than Justin, but Jagpreet, you can feel free to respond as well. So we've had this conversation about the numbers of South Asians who voted for Trump but also voted for the mayor. 10% apparently of Trump voters also voted for Mayor Mamdani. And I'm curious if you could reflect on what this duality means. What does this say about our ability to mobilize? I mean, you can speak to whatever you want, but I think what I feel is interesting here is that we have the opportunity to mobilize AAPI voters for progressive candidates, regardless of what their past voting behavior has been.
So without like a political lens to it, I think that people often vote for what's in their best self-interest, and specifically within immigrant communities. And, you know, the more recent the immigrant community is, the more stronger you'll see collectivism as opposed to individualism. And that is what makes immigrant communities in New York so unique, and I think in the country, is that we will still show up for each other in ways in which other communities are like baffled a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think what the 2024 election illustrated was that people's needs were not being met by the previous administration, and it was all the economy. And while they did make massive investments in like the Build Back Better program, which was going to do massive infrastructure improvements, it's like $100 billion in investments across the country. None of that means anything if you still are paying $6 for a gallon of milk, right? So when people voted in 2024, what you ended up seeing was they were voting with their pockets and their hearts. A lot of people had been seeing a genocide unfolding in front of their eyes and feeling as if the United States was being more than complicit in that genocide, and specifically within the South Asian and Muslim community, that ends up being like a bigger issue for them. But when you speak to the broader immigrant community, especially the South Asian community and the East Asian community as well, when you spoke to people, because we did deep canvassing to understand better people's rationale and the way in which they voted, and it literally came down to three things. They couldn't afford living here, so housing was like a huge issue, and their rents were sky high. They needed massive improvements, and they weren't getting it from their landlords. They couldn't afford to buy food, and food costs were increasing significantly, and they didn't feel like there was economic opportunity for themselves or their families. And these are specific issues that we found within the Chinese community in South Brooklyn, and then the South East Asian community and the South Asian community in separate parts of Queens. So for us, what we understood was that when you are not speaking to the people that you want to elect you, they will not elect you. Mm-hmm. And when you're not addressing the issues that people are feeling every day, that's not going to help you either. And what you ended up seeing in the candidacy of Zoran Mamdani is that he actually spoke to these broader issues that everyone was facing. The affordability crisis, the housing crisis, the crisis of wanting to have a family but not being able to afford it because childcare is so expensive. So when someone who's speaking, you know, I asked my mom, not being like, you know, telling her who to vote for. I was like, who would you vote for, knowing everyone's platforms? And the funny part is she started talking about one of the other candidates and how just seeing them on TV brought her relief during the pandemic. But then after 30 minutes of her spiel on, reliving COVID, she also then went into, but they're also the reason why we have the affordability crisis, why housing is so expensive, why a million people died because of their lack of leadership and their bad decision making. And then went into, it's not because he's a young person, it's because he's bringing the ideas that are old with a younger, fresher perspective in this moment. And, you know, my mom is someone who is one of the most strongest women I've ever met in my life, raised 7 kids on her own, had several massive health issues, and continues to try to stay tapped into things, was only able to go to second grade. So accessibility in that moment, to me, illustrated that one campaign was actually speaking to her while the others were ignoring her. So I think my mom's example illustrates a lot of what other immigrant families, and specifically South Asian and the entire Asian diaspora, was feeling.
So specifically for the Southeast Asian community, so when we do our civic engagement with folks, we do like voter mobilization. So we have community events or community meetings to have our folks come and we share the candidates and who, like what they are, what they're standing on and key things for our community, because we're a 501c3, we can't tell folks who to vote for. But we want to make sure that our community like understands, it really understands who's going to be like helping them, what are they like fighting for, because we know our community, they need a lot of support in like healthcare and housing, and a lot of things that Mayor Mangdani was saying, it really touched folks and it really like wanted them to align with him and stuff like that. But it's just like our folks, they came through with like a lot of trauma and stuff like that, so they were just scared. It reminded them of the past when they first resettled to America, coming here, putting into already disinvested communities, and based off of that, it's just like who can help them more and stuff like that. And for Mekong, we try to really help our community members in understanding a lot of these things and understanding that community power and community building is very important, especially during these times. We have to make our community understand what's going on and what's happening. A lot of things are changing, and these times are very scary. We don't know what the next day may hold, but as long as we educate our community members and have them understand what's going on, that's most important.
I have to be nonpartisan about this, so I'm going to... So I think there's a way how to normally do elections that's a tried and tested method that's been happening for years, right? This is how you build out your voter engagement universe, is usually people who have voted X number of times in the past. You send out mailers. I'm sure many of you are already starting to get mailers if you're in New York City and you're living in a competitive assembly race. You send out 4 or 5 mailers to this community. You knock on this many doors. That method may have worked, but it completely ignores our communities. Our communities are not prime voters for the most part. They are not the most engaged. They are not caring about what comes in the mailer. Oftentimes in my household, the mails get thrown out even before they make it onto the dining room table. Yet there are other candidates, when our mayor ran for office, but other presidential candidates who have seen the power that comes from engaging communities in culturally competent ways. Doesn't matter what side of the spectrum they come from, they will go to the religious event that nobody's heard of before. They will go to certain community leaders that everybody in that community trusts, but you know, your average council member or state senator hasn't heard of them. It's a lack of imagination that has come from mainstream politics that have let the extremes in many ways adopt these more imaginative scenarios and these more imaginative tactics that have allowed them to, frankly, make ground. And I think this last election, this last mayoral election, has really opened the bubble, and I think a lot more of the mainstream, a lot more of the traditional have now seen, are also starting to adopt these more culturally competent methods. But Trump did that. Trump did that in 2016. He did that in 2020. He had Asian American community centers in places like Nevada and New Jersey. He had people who were willing to stump for him on the ground within and from the communities, who went on tours to the very various Little Indias and Little Saigons of America to make sure that people were out there. and didn't take the community for granted like it's been taken for granted for decades and centuries.
Thank you for that. And it reminds me, you know, the class that I was teaching at CUNY this year is called The Politics of Immigration, and we studied the last 25 years. And it was like PTSD going through the 25 years that we've lived through, right? And there's a remarkable ad that President Bush put out that I can share with you. It's a video ad that was mailed to Latino households talking about Latino contributions to this country. I mean, it's like if you watch this ad, obviously with a critical eye, you want to kind of be grossed out. But there is a way that where you could feel very uplifted by this. And one of the things we used to talk about back in the day now it feels like a crazy conversation, but that it is right that the communities were ignored and that there was always this fear that if we got a pathway to citizenship, that we would create 11 million Democrats. And that is definitely not what would happen. Like, actually, there is an opening for both parties or more to attract our community, right? And so I'm just doubling down on the nonpartisan, but I think you all know where I stand on this. Like, the continued ignoring of our communities has gotten us to this point.
I think a great example of the way to see how this played out in the last mayoral election is to read Yeshka Dutt's pieces on Substack around the last election. She covered greatly how, especially within the South Asian communities, every candidate was trying to figure out the unique and impressive way to be able to build within the community.
And then in City and State, she also has a cover article from last week just talking about, you know, how this election mobilized the Asian American community and particularly the South Asian community. So I am going to be opening it up for questions in a few minutes, but I have one question before the public, before I open it up to you all. And that is, you know, I have some experience going from being on the outside to being on the inside, right? And then things changed when I became commissioner. All of a sudden, everybody was banging on my door. Rightfully, we were, it was 6 months after September 11th. We were in a kind of similar situation in terms of needing to protect our immigrant communities. And so I want to talk about what it means now. And I thought, you know, particularly for Jagpreet and Murad to talk about what it means to be in the administration and in the inner circle, and how that influences this idea of co-governance. Like, how do we work on an outside-inside strategy? Because that is how, I mean, that's how we got things done when I was in the Bloomberg administration. I was not in an administration that was sympathetic or enthusiastic about doing what was needed to protect immigrant identities. But we had elected a number of new city council members, including John Liu. And so there was a strategy that included the kind of legislative branch, the New York Immigration Coalition under Margie McHugh and Cheng Hua, and then myself in the administration. This is a very different moment because there are so many organizers who were not in government before, who are now in government. There are people like you, Murad, who are close to the administration. So I wonder if you all could reflect on what kind of tensions and opportunities that creates.
You're not in the administration? I see you like every day. I don't know how else to do it than the kind of co-governance inside-outside method that we're testing out now. It is very easy to get sucked into the minutiae of City Hall and the bureaucracy and to be blinded to what's happening on the outside. But at the end of the day, our mayor has really empowered us to be able to reach out to external stakeholders, to organizations who hold expertise on the ground, to really have an understanding of what are the issues, and then also what are the solutions? Not just here are our problems, but help us figure out what the solution for these problems are. You know, we're only a couple of months in, so this is still in many ways in its infancy, and these are methods that we're still trying and testing out. But within our office, within the Office of Mass Engagement, lives a co-governance director and a co-governance department that's really working hard to make sure, whether it's around childcare, whether it's around the budget, whether it's around libraries, that we're bringing in external stakeholders who truly understand and are truly impacted by these issues to be able to help build some guidance, to help give us some leadership and context and understanding of how to move forward. I think, you know, as I said, I've been on the outside for a decade and a half, and I've seen over and over again things that are simple solutions in many ways to the problems that we face. But just because you don't have the right ear or you're not able to say it in the right way, they never get addressed. And that's the experience that many of us, much of the folks within the administration, and I'll speak for our office at the Office of Mass Engagement, don't come from government. We are organizers, we're activists, we're people who, again, have been fighting on the outside, and those relationships are the ones that we're bringing into the work that we're doing. Those conversations are the ones that we're bringing into the work that we're doing.
I think I'm seeing this firsthand, which is, it is a breath of fresh air. I think this administration's way of working is not trying to pit communities against each other, which has been something that every previous administration has done, including progressive ones. I think for under Zoran's leadership, I think that what is going to be the test is not, you know, what he's able to save within the budget. And that's been like the huge conversation over the past couple of weeks, is he came in facing a massive deficit, right? And folks were like, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. He's being set up for failure. And I think that what he was able to do within the state budget and reallocating, this is not a bailout. I think people want to keep saying that. New York City is the economic heartbeat of this state. And without New York City's money, which we never get back, we would not have a New York State. Let's leave it at that. So we are getting in some form, and I don't like using this word in this case, but it is sort of like reparations back to the city of New York. I think if we are able to continue to power through and illustrate that government can work for working people, then he will be successful. That will be the measure of success. Mm-hmm. I think the other piece is like, look, this is a new administration. Everyone expected you to hit the ground running on day one with all your hires and all your everything being put in place, and that's not how government works. And government is slow, regardless of who's leading it. So you need to be able to give them some time to make the changes that you need, that people want to see too. And I think that that's the piece that is most disconcerting for people who are super jazzed up about this new administration. Is like they're it's going to be amazing on day one. All is going to change. No, it's not. Give it at least a couple months, maybe a year. I think where the tension is going to be is, you know, one thing we want to see is more services. We've had an enormous amount of cuts over the past 4 years. We witnessed and lived through austerity under Mayor Eric Adams, and it continued to happen until the very last day of his office. And we need to see more investment. I think that is where the tension is going to end up being. Like, he just put out his executive budget the other day, right? And there are no cuts to services, but we needed more services, right? So how are we going to make those investments more the most critical ones immediately, and how are we going to pace ourselves to do more down the road? So I think that is where we are going to, you know, see some tension. But I think other than that, I think the administration's on a good off to a good start and needs to continue to push forward and think of every day as if it's their first day.
And for us as well, to think about this as, think about election as not the ceiling, but the floor, mm-hmm. You know. Questions from the audience? Go ahead, Daryl.
So large portions of each of your respective communities are non-citizens. Talking about green card holders, partially documented, undocumented. Do you engage them politically, and if so, how?
You don't need to be a citizen to knock on doors. You don't need to be a citizen to phone bank. You don't need to be a citizen to talk about what issues you're facing every single day living in a city that you are contributing to. And I think that that has been something that has been pushed out to our community since day one. You are not a citizen. Do not talk about elections. And that's wrong. We push for the Our City, Our Vote campaign. And we worked with Drum and Mekong and a bunch of organizations to actually get it over the finish line. And then it was sued in court, and we appealed and appealed and appealed and unfortunately lost. But that would have allowed for people who are here who have lawful status to be able to vote in elections, in municipal elections. And I think that historically that's what happened in this country. It's not a thing that we innovated. We were like, hey, you're a landowner, you can vote regardless of immigration status. Why do you need to be, you know, a U.S. citizen to vote? We ran this campaign for over a decade plus, and we won, and then unfortunately it got struck down. But I do think that every single person, regardless of your immigration status, has power. And in our organization, we see civic engagement on a spectrum, so it doesn't ever end. So if you are someone without status, how are you able to gain status? How are you able to move through that process to get to green card, then to citizenship, and then to voter, and then, you know, maybe an elected official one day? And thinking about it, where the spectrum doesn't end, it's just continual. So everyone has a role to play, and I know that not everyone wants to become a U.S. citizen for various reasons, but you still have power to engage in the electorate.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree with Maraza, too, because it's really important. Just because you're not documented or anything like that, it's still important to be aware. Awareness is key, especially in these times right now. Everybody should understand what's going on, what's happening. And also, a lot of times, their children are citizens as well, too, so they can have the chance to vote and to be understanding what's going on and what's happening, too.
We just launched our first campaign at the Office of Mass Engagement, or Organize NYC, to go knock on doors of rent-stabilized tenants and encourage them to come out and testify at the rent guideline boards hearing that are happening across the city. And part of the work that we're trying to do is build out a robust volunteer network within OME who can take on these efforts, take on these campaigns, run the field campaigns around, whether it's knocking on doors for Know Your Rights, whether it's around rent guidelines board hearing. But one thing we're not doing is asking for immigration status for the people who are volunteering with us, for the people whose doors we're knocking, the people who we're serving, the folks who are coming in for constituency services. That is not and will never be within our administration a barrier for folks to come into City Hall to come and receive our services or to work with us.
You know, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was in 2001. Until 2001, parents with children in the public school system could run for school board elections. And then mayoral control sort of changed that. But it's very much in our recent history. And I think for another panel, a conversation, you know, you brought up Murad, you brought up Obama's Families Not Felons. And I feel like he was sort of that critical turning point in our conversation, like in a very kind of neoliberal way to make us think about good citizen, bad citizen. And this conversation is reminding me of how, yeah, not everybody wants to be a citizen. I mean, there's also participatory budgeting. I think you can participate in that, even if you are not eligible to vote. And I didn't become a citizen until after I had started SIA, until after I had done exit polling, until after I had been into the polling booth with friends. It was not the culmination of my experience. It was just another marker. So I do think it's important to, like, have that conversation with our folks and to be cognizant of the fact that not everybody wants to hold that American passport.
I've been on the street in my community a lot. I think you can attest to that. And one of the things I kept hearing is that I'm not a citizen.
Yeah.
So I'll have to work hard and convince people that you don't have to be a citizen to be civically engaged.
So I'm concerned that nonprofits are not doing enough of the same thing. This is why I asked the question.
Well, thank you for the work. And now you have some examples to share. Any other questions? Yes.
Hi. So I'm also someone who came from both, I've been in the inside and on the outside. I'm currently on the outside now. And I wanted to say that, yes, local governments, all governments should have more community organizers. We need in order to get the work done for our communities. My wondering, though, is, you know, as there's been such a rich sort of group of folks who have entered the current administration as organizers, how are we going to work to ensure that the ecosystem that supports this work, meaning the community-based organizations, they are also developing and deepening their bench of organizers and the next generation of folks so that it's not only the administration who's continuing to sort of run these campaigns or door campaigns, but we also are building a robust community-based network of folks.
I think part of the thing that I looked at before jumping into government, into the position I'm in currently, was what does the future hold for the position that I held previously as a political director? I wanted to make sure that we had a pipeline ready and folks activated who, A, can take the position that I was in, but then wherever they're coming from, there's somebody behind them. And what I saw is that in the last couple of years, post-COVID especially, especially within the South Asian, I can't speak for the larger Asian community, but within the South Asian community here in New York City, a resurgence that in many ways started especially during the BLM protests but has continued on post-COVID into some of the anti-immigration raid work and anti-ICE work, where, again, there is a view beyond the model minority myth, beyond the kind of very specific type of opportunities that have been open to the community, especially young people within the community, to take up organizing, to take up activism, to take up political spaces, to make sure that their voices are heard and to build their own leadership. The organization I used to work for at Drum has a very robust youth engagement program, youth membership, to make sure that folks are coming up through the organization. 90% of the staff who are at Drum were Drum youth at one point or another, or had, like myself, come in as volunteers. I think it's very important for movements, organizations, to take this on as a very serious role of engaging youth, of building out those pipelines, and making sure that there are future leaders who are ready. Because more and more, I often end up seeing organizations who are run by one charismatic person who, if anything ever happened to them, that organization is gone. There is no pipeline. So I really encourage everybody within your movements, within your organizations, within your collectives, to make sure you're building up that pipeline, you're training youth, and you're having people who are going to be ready to take over your position.
I want to just add, that I think there's room for us to be exploring alternative leadership models that ensure, there is the charismatic, problematic leader, then there's the long-term founders that stay on. And some of, I've been thinking a lot about my friend and hero, Urvashi Ved, who died yesterday, who died four years ago yesterday. And one of the things that was especially tragic about Urvashi, who was a national LGBTQ leader, but that's like putting that title to her diminishes the breadth of work that she did. She died of cancer. She died having to hustle, working so that she could have her health insurance paid. And I remember being at her memorial 4 years ago thinking, maybe we couldn't have controlled whether she died or not or when she died, but we might have been able to ensure that she was held in a way that didn't require this kind of hustle. And I do think that a lot of our leaders, and I'm not excusing this behavior, a lot of leaders stay on because there isn't also a pipeline for the older generation. Like, where do we go once we stop running organizations? And so I think that looking at it across the spectrum of our, and then helping these jobs be meaningful, thriving wage jobs as opposed to minimum wage jobs for our young people, helping our elders see community organizing as an actual career. I think it's like a pretty robust set of mandates that we have to ensure that the sector survives, and that there is there. I mean, when I think about this moment that we are in, and what the last, you know, from the 1990s, we were building organizations that named South Asian as an umbrella. And like there was a lot of politics around that, right? Because we were building these organizations, and then we were being told that we weren't allowed in certain spaces because those spaces were homophobic and Islamophobic. And it's like they felt like niche activities, but each of those niche organizations created a tent that didn't exist before, and then allowed us over time to expand that tent. So, yeah, I just wanted to take a little generational privilege and name that, like, there are all these things that we have to work on. And I wish we could, you know, this is why you need General Hospital, because the work isn't going to end tomorrow or with the election of Mayor Mamdani or his reelection. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to the organizer piece. I think one aspect of we are all operating in a white supremacist system and society. And I think that when we're talking about deconstructing white supremacy, we can't do it by just electing a mayor that is from our community. Just going to put that out there. I think that there's always, and I feel like it's a setup for failure when you think that way, because then you're setting yourself up for failure as well. And I started organizing as a young person in my community many moons ago. I'm really sad that I have to say decades now. But one thing I learned really early on was that the worst problem that government could ever have when they are the arbiter of injustice is organized people. Because organized people beat organized money every day of the week. And oftentimes what people often get dissuaded from wanting to do organizing at a very hyper-local level is like there's politics and then there's like egos and all these other things. And one thing I did for a long time when I first entered the space was I honestly was just like a sponge and I absorbed everything. And I realized I wouldn't ever do the thing that I just saw happen in front of me if I were in that position. So I think, yes, it is all of our responsibility to build out the bench. It's not one institution's responsibility. There should be bench building everywhere, and intentional bench building. Not to say I have, you know, we have 150,000 members who are doing what when you only have like 10 people working at your organization. Like, it doesn't make any sense. I think the bigger piece here is making sure that you're doing intentional leadership development. And with that comes the experience that they're going to need so that they're not set up for failure when they enter a position of leadership, but also being able to build community. Because if you can't build community, then how do you define yourself as being an organizer in that moment?
Any more questions? Yes.
In the campaign, we saw alignment of like working class identity, and then sort of left politics. But in current campaigns, and if you don't feel comfortable to answer, you could say we're seeing actually a split where we have some districts where there's a South Asian candidate but doesn't have the same working class politics, and then another candidate that's not South Asian. So I'm just wondering. I think we're going to see more of that. And this not it's like different jurisdictions that I'm thinking about in my brain. I don't want to name names, but how do we navigate? Like, it came together so nicely here, but it's a tent that's not necessary, that still has to build this relationship, right? So I'm just wondering if you had some wisdom or some thoughts about how to navigate this space where it's not about identity, you know, and there's this sort of left formation, and then there's working class politics. And they don't always overlap. It overlapped here today. So how do we navigate moving forward?
I was going to ask a closing question. I suggest that we make this a closing question, and sort of broaden it to, like, how do we move forward? given some of that, I want to just add also, like, what does it mean to build socialism in a multiracial environment? Because we don't have a lot of experiences of that around the world. And so, you know, in your closing thoughts, if you can just reflect on where we go from here for New York City and even nationally.
Yeah, I would, to slightly answer your question in a way that I can with the hat that I'm wearing today, is that I think people often who were looking at what happened in the primary and general election, they thought everything just happened naturally and easily. That is work. It is work to put together a big tent. It is work to keep the tent together. It is work to move the campaign forward. So I don't think that it was where you had like opposite ends of the coalition coming at with each other. You were building a tent built on the premise of we are fighting for working people, and that is how you can win. And I think you see a lot of these people who think that social media is the way that they're going to win elections now, right? And they have these walking, talking video of someone running for office, I just want to punch him in the face. It's like, what are you doing? But now you sort of see that as being like the standard pack of someone like doing anything. You have elected officials who lost their elections in other races, who are now running for other races and thinking that if they just did the social media, they will win. And it's like, no, it's not what platforms you're using. It's what you're putting out on the platforms and what you're saying. I think nationally what we are seeing is, you know, I'm not saying this and saying that they have a lot of the same shared values. They don't. But Zoran and Trump spoke to the same set of people. People who are struggling, people who are working class, people who are poor, people who are trying to make it in life to live. And they convinced them that they had power. And if we want to talk about what you need to do on the national level to win, is that. Because, again, organized people beats organized money every day of the week. And what we have seen is the billionaire class in this nation continue to wage war against our communities by raiding our coffers, raiding our dollars. They just had the largest wealth transfer in U.S. history with H.R. 1 last year. And it's as if we all forgot already. Nearly $1 trillion of our money and our kids will have to pay that debt back to make sure that billionaire has got $5,000 to $1 million tax break. So I think what we need to start really doing is talking to people. And if we're not speaking to people in an accessible, culturally competent way, we are not going to win.
Against all the things that you're talking about,
just
different
kind
of politics.
So
I wanted to, like, engage in that tension.
Yeah, I just want to say that, like, just because don't do organizing just because of elections. Organizing happens every single day. Always organize. Build community power. That's the main important thing. We have to build our communities up to be seen, to be heard. Thank you.
Post-election, I got interviewed by a number of political pundits and newspapers, and there were a big part of the question I got was, you know, Drum had put out statistics of increases within certain South Asian communities of how much their voter propensity had increased, and the kind of conclusion many of the reporters had drawn is, oh, a South Asian turns out South Asians. And my number one pushback is off of the top of my head, still to this day, I can name you 20 plus South Asian candidates who have run in districts that are way more South Asian than the entire city is, who have lost, and lost bad. Maybe two of them have won. One, we don't talk about them. It is not identity. Identity is not persuasive enough to bring out communities to come out and vote in the numbers that we saw in this previous election. It is all of a sudden seeing big issues like housing instability, issues like worker protection, issues like the inequality that we're facing, to be your issues is what really radicalized and activated voters. On top of the hard work, it wasn't just the social media, as Murat said, it was the hard work of knocking hundreds of thousands of doors, of activating millions of people to go out there and do that, of making millions of phone calls. And none of this happens in a vacuum. It happens because people are sick and tired of where things were. People are sick and tired of having their own communities exploited. People are sick and tired of gatekeepers and leaders within their own communities not doing crap for them, but increasing their own images. And this is what led to the culmination. Our communities, especially our working class communities, aren't stupid. And the establishment and the institutions for a long time thought they were stupid. It is candidates who actually put faith, leadership within our working class who understand the issues and are then able to activate them. That is what we need more of. We need to come to our people. We need to come to our folks with humility and learn from them is how we're going to be able to build within those communities.
I also think that this year-round organizing and voter education helps our communities become savvier about what to look for in a candidate so that some of you have said this, right? Like, we have been ignored so often that when someone comes by and gives you even a little bit of attention, it compared to someone who's giving you no attention, it's very easy to be seduced by that. And the work I think that we have to do as organizers is make our communities savvier about demanding things throughout the year, and holding our candidates and our elected officials accountable. So all we've done is given you hard work today, but let's remember that we are celebrating an important victory that many of you in this room and certainly all of you here contributed to, and that, like, it is not a small thing. I mean, you said it's only been a couple of months, and we're counting it's probably more like 4 or 5. But he's done a tremendous job, and there have been things that we already have had to push back on, that the mayor has had the humility and the wisdom and the support to address up front. And a lot of that is work that people in this room have done. So I want to thank you all for being here, for being really upfront and honest about the moment that we're in, for giving us a call to action and giving us some ideas. I want to know what sticker bombing is. Can you explain what sticker? Is it like what's on your phone?
Yeah, kind of like this. But anything that you like.
Okay. So get yourself some stickers. Do what you need to do. And I'll close by telling you that I tell my students this now, that, like, there's people keep saying, oh, things haven't been this hard, and we know that for many communities things have always been hard. We know that things have been differently hard. But what we also know is that there's no way that all of us are going to go away. And so we have a lot of power in numbers and in the positions that we now hold and in the possibilities that that we are all bringing to both the electoral process and to the democracy and the economy writ large. So thank you. I hope you feel energized by this panel and by the rest of the day.